everybody, and welcome to the Alton Brown cast. Actually, we still don't know what to call this. There's been a lot of debate on Twitter and in social media. I was calling it the Brown cast. People said that sounds like downcast. That's not good. And although we had a lot of suggestions, the favorite of which was Brown and Serve. That's creepy, and I don't know why. So I was going with just the Alton Brown show, but it's not technically a show, is it? In this day and age, it's a cast. So I guess we should call it the Alton Brown cast. Maybe that'll be better in the long run. But maybe during the day, as we get calls in, somebody will come with a better name. But let me kind of tell you what our mission statement is going to be for this little project. We're going to be looking at food news, kind of current events going on in the world of food. We're going to deal with your calls. You're going to be calling in. And here's the way that this is going to work. The conference room can only hold so many people. So if you call and you get a little recorded message saying that the conference is locked, that sounds pretty grim, but it just means that it's going to be a few minutes. Just call us back in a couple of minutes. But hey, you can also reach us other ways. If you want to just email us a question, the email address for that is askalton@altonbrown.com. That's long. We're trying to get it shorter. Just live with it for now. All lowercase. And of course, you can reach me on Twitter just about any time. And that's at Alton Brown. You can also send your questions there. So we're going to try to deal with the things that are on your mind. So we're going to get to those later. And we also have celebrity interviews that we're going to be doing here in the studio. And we have our first celebrity here today. She is standing by in the green room enjoying a large deli platter and some special soda water that we had to ship in from Peru for her. So that's nice how that's going. But of course, you can't get any you know, real high level people unless you've got a really, really nice green room. And I can say myself that the nicest green room I've encountered has been the one on Craig Ferguson's show. That was so nice that I actually stole about 24 cupcakes and brought them home. That was pretty great. The worst green room that I've encountered would definitely be the Letterman show, where there's actually not so much a green room as small cells that are someplace that you would expect to be interrogated by people that were in the Romanian KGB at some point. I mean, there might be an actual green room somewhere else in that theater, but they don't let, you know, low level quasi celebs like me into it. So anyway, ours is state of the art, pinball machines, foosball. So if you are a celebrity and you're asked to come be on the show, you'll probably want to do it just for the quality of the green room. Right, the food quote of the day on the Brown cast is this, and this is from Horace Fletcher. More about him in a second, but he said, "Nature will castigate those who don't masticate." That's right. Let me read that again. Famous quote, "Nature will castigate those who don't masticate." That, of course, from Horace Fletcher, who was an American health food guru from the late 19th century, known as the Great Masticator. He believed that every mouthful of food should be chewed 100 times. So I'm Alton Brown. This is the Alton Brown cast, looking over some news. A lot of food in the news lately, and a lot of it has to do with GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Of course, people have been really complaining about these laws or trying to be set about labeling them. And my first story today actually comes from a website that I like a lot that you ought to check out. It's called foodnavigator-usa.com. And it's probably, you know, in the last year or so, it's really become almost my number one, my first source for food news. This comes from Elaine Watson, who wrote up a piece about the Vermont House of Representatives passed finally House Bill 112, which requires the labeling of all genetically engineered food sold inside Vermont. I'm pretty sure this is the first state to do this. I know that the bill's still got to be approved by the Senate, but I'm betting that somewhere early in 2014, this is probably going to become law. And if it does, that is certainly going to set some precedences. I know that the bill, I've seen a short version of the bill, includes some of the controversial clauses that have been kind of enshrined in California Proposition 37, including the stipulation that foods contain genetically engineered ingredients cannot be marked as natural. And you know what? I'm kind of, you know, let's face it. If nature makes it, you ought to be able to call it natural. And the word natural in our food vernacular is really overused anyway. And the truth is, in legalese in the United States, it simply means something that nothing's been added to. I mean, you can call some really, really horrible things natural. But I think that this is probably a good thing. I mean, we do need some delineation. I'm not about to say that genetically modified organisms are bad. The truth is, they're going to happen. They are happening. And you know what? If we manage them right,
I mean, I don't like it, but I think that if we're going to feed all the people on this planet, we're probably going to have to do some of this. Keeping it, you know, controlled is going to be the big problem. So I think that this is good. This next one, also about genetically modified organisms, comes from NPR.org. And Mary Claire Jelinek, as I think how you say her name, Jelinek maybe, who writes often for them. And it's about some genetically engineered wheat that has just kind of shown up in a field in Oregon. A farmer discovered this stuff on his farm and contacted Oregon State University, and they called, I think they notified the USDA. And it turns out this farmer discovered this stuff when farm workers were trying to knock off and kill some plants that had not popped up properly during harvest. It's, you know, makes sense that if the plant's not going to give you grain, you get rid of it, you kill it. And so the farmer used an herbicide called glyphosate to kill the plants, and they didn't die. So he started wondering about that. And so some folks from Oregon State tested it and find out that it was indeed genetically engineered to resist herbicides. Now, here's the funny thing. A lot of corn and soybeans grown in the U.S. Have already been modified, but not the country's wheat crop. Okay. Now, Monsanto created some varieties of Roundup Ready wheat, and they carried out field trials in, I want to say it was 16 states, if I remember reading it properly, but the wheat growers in this country told the company they didn't want it. They weren't going to deal with it. And for a lot of reasons, most of all being that, you know, wheat is heavily traded internationally, and there's a lot of pushback about genetically engineered foods abroad. So anyway, Monsanto drops the project, never applied for governmental approval. And I think that they ended their, this article says that the field trials of wheat stopped back in 2005. In Oregon, the field trials stopped in 2001. So all of a sudden, boom, this stuff pops up again, which makes you wonder if we can actually control this stuff once we make it. You know, it reminds me of a line that Dr. Malcolm has in the book Jurassic Park, when he's saying, you know, life will find a way. And here's the deal. Mark my words, the repercussions of this is that wheat prices are going to fall, because foreign buyers, certainly in Asia, are going to freak out when they hear this. This from the same website: Japan blocks wheat imports after an illegal GMO scare in Utah. So what, of course, happens is that they find out about this. This, by the way, the follow-up story written by Casey Colony over at foodnavigator-usa.com. So here's the thing. Of course, they say that they're not going to buy this stuff anymore. So who, you know, we're America. So somebody's going to file a lawsuit, right? And indeed, a lawsuit's been filed against Monsanto. This time, I think it's by a Kansas farmer seeking an excess of $100,000 in damages following a discovery that has alienated importers of U.S. wheat. So this guy now, he can't get his right price for the wheat anymore because the market's dumping because of this mysterious GM wheat that shows up on an Oregon farm. All right, kids, it's time to listen to some more news, food news, on this edition or episode of the Alton Browncast. Those of you that are terrified or suffer from sphenopalatine ganglioneuralgia or brain freeze might want to know where that comes from. People actually study this kind of stuff, and a gentleman named Gwen Goodwin, a PhD neuroscientist at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center, explained this recently to some folks at a website called foodproductdesign.com, which I check out from time to time to see what's going on. Explains that basically a lot of blood moving around your mouth. You got major arteries even that go up near the back of your throat. I think it's the carotid artery, which feeds blood to the brain. You got the anterior cerebral artery, which is all, it's all back there, right? It's all back behind your mouth. And so what happens is when you quickly consume something really, really cold, the temperature at the back of your throat changes very, very quickly. And these big vessels basically dilate and contract to try to respond to the changing temperature, and your brain interprets that as pain. So to prevent this, you could like sip some, you know, like lukewarm water while you're eating your ice cream or whatever, or maybe just when you're drinking your milkshake or chugging your margarita, just don't chug. Go slow, and you won't have that happen to you. For those of you that follow sustainable seafood, Greenpeace just released their grocery store scores. They do this, they don't do it every year, but they've been doing it for a while now, where basically they rate different grocery stores in America based upon their sustainability practices. They include general policies, initiatives, transparency, and what they call red list inventory, or the caring of fish that are considered to be endangered or overfished, at the very least. Every one of those categories is given a score, and then they total them up and see who wins. This year, I noticed that they gave special accommodation to both Wegmans and Harris Teeter for transparency. But looking over at the general scores of who did really, really well and who didn't maybe do so well. And most of these stores, by the way, were voluntary. A couple of them weren't. I think that both Publix and Bilo, which is also, I think, part of Winn-Dixie, did not voluntarily throw in on this. So, you know, maybe we should ignore where they fall on this because I don't know what the politics are. Number one on the list, Whole Foods. Whole Foods got a 7.3. That is the highest score for any seafood retailer in the United States. Good going, Whole Foods. Safeway followed that. Then Trader Joe's, Wegmans at number four, Harris Teeter at number five. A surprise for me at number six, Target. Let's see, looking down the list, I won't go over all of it. Some of the big ones, you've got Walmart, number 11, Costco, number 13, A&P, 15, Bilo and Publix were at the bottom. But you know what? I think it's hard to kind of judge that because of the fact that they didn't, take voluntary part in that. But it's an important study, I think. You know what? If you want to learn more about sustainable seafood, drop by the Seafood Watch website, and you can look up the Seafood Watch. That's what I use almost each and every week before I buy my seafood. This actually is not really big news, but I've kind of been collecting stories about this. The one that I'm going to quote here is from the Huffington Post. I think it was written by Peggy Lowe. I've got at least 40 articles on this about the fact that, and you may already know this, Smithfield, as in Smithfield Ham, which is the world's biggest pork producer, has been snatched up, purchased by Shuanggui, I think is how you say it, International Holdings, Shuanggui maybe is how you say that. I need to learn Mandarin, which is a very, very large Chinese food company who's had some troubles in the not too distant past regarding some issues with tainted food. But now the folks at Shuanggui have purchased Smithfield lock, stock, and barrel, approximate price of $4.72 billion. Smithfield shareholders being paid $34 a share under this deal, and that's quite a premium. I don't know. Last time I looked at the company stock prices, I think it was around $25, $26. So, pretty good deal for them. Makes you wonder. I mean, this is a company. You know, you think that you know who Smithfield Ham is. We're talking about the brands include Armour, Eckridge, Kretschmar, a bunch of others, Gwaltney. So a lot of what look like kind of small or regional meat packers are actually all under the Smithfield brand. And it's an old company. It goes back to the 30s when they really did, just make ham. So here's the question, America, riddle me this. Why does a Chinese company want Smithfield? Well, they're not trying to flood us with their products, but Smithfield, they've had some real challenges from kind of environmental management. So China's pretty smart. They're going to buy it up. They're going to get all the pork, but leave all the nastiness over here, which is pretty smart of them. What's it mean to us? Well, just another big chunk of America owned by China. And if you don't have a problem with that, you don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with that. Well, I think that's about enough news for today. We will, of course, keep an eye, a journalistic eye, sharp on the horizon for new things that might be of concern to you and your food world. All right. Well, today's food of the day on the Browncast is the humble strawberry, and a couple of facts about strawberries that you might not know. For instance, the seeds on the outside of the strawberry, those are actually the fruit. Strawberries, member of the rose family. And get this, I like this. In Bavaria, strawberries are sometimes tied to the horns of cattle as an offering to elves. Now, I don't know what to say about that, but apparently there's still some kind of mischievous elf problem in Bavaria, and they like strawberries. This is the Alto Browncast coming to you from the little room above the garage in my house. We're talking about food, food news, food issues, and we're very soon going to turn to our celebrity guest of the day, who is still cooling her heels in our sumptuous and palatial green room here at Brown Industries, and that's coming along in just a few moments. This would typically be a time in a podcast where I would give you a word from our sponsors, but we don't have any freaking sponsors because it's a brand new podcast. So if you happen to be listening to this and you're a big corporate with lots of spare change rolling around, hey, give us a call, get in touch, reach out, we'll be here.
Now we're moving into our celebrity interview segment. And this is a very important part of any podcast. In fact, a lot of people have told me a podcast is judged by and large by what kind of celebrities you can lure up to the microphones. We have a very nice green room here, which is really a big part of luring those people because you can't actually pay them. So they have to have a couple of things going for them. Most celebrities will come to podcasts because you've got a palatial green room. You're on their way to work anyway, or if they've got something they're trying to sell. Strictly a PR thing. 90% of the podcasts that I've been on have been because I was, you know, trying to move books, which is, you know, pretty much all I have to sell. But the celebrity that we have today does have a very, very interesting product, a product that has got a real kind of cult following, at least in our neck of the woods. And these are, I'm actually going to open this little bag. It's a brown bag. Our celebrity today keeps these in very nondescript. This packaging is very kind of stealth-like. There's no logo. There's no name because she doesn't actually want people knowing that she's making these. And the second that I open this bag, the room is filled with these amazing aromas. I get cheese and some spice and kind of a baked good feel. And you can if you'd smell this through the mic, which I know you can't, you would know that I've got my nose stuck down into about a 1 pound bag of cheese dots. If you're not from the South, you might not know what a cheese dot is. Well, you know what a cheese straw is, right? Of course. Well, this is just kind of a dot version. It's a round version of that. And you may have already figured this out, but today's celebrity guest is Sandy Waddell. Sandy, thanks for taking the time to be here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, if you don't know who Sandy Waddell is, then you're really not cool and not in the know and living under a rock because, I mean, all the cool people, especially in the culinary world, know Sandy very, very, very well. Sandy is known for making these cheese dots. Now, you don't do this with your entire year. This isn't the only thing that you do, right? But at certain times of the year, you set everything else aside in your busy career, especially when you're done with the Broadway season and you come back home and you start making these amazing cheese dots. Now, is it okay if I have one?
Yes, please. Help yourself.
We'll talk later about when I get tickets. I know you're going to be back in your Broadway show once you're done with the CD tour. And once you're done with that, I'm hoping I can get tickets because I wasn't able to last time. That is the best freaking cheese dot I've ever. Now, do you call them cheese dots?
I do.
Why? Okay. What and tell me something. It's divine, by the way. And I don't want you to talk because I want to just sit here and eat these. What is the difference between a cheese straw and a cheese dot?
Basically, the dye you used when in the cookie press.
No, when you mean dye, you don't mean a color. You mean the shape of the thing that you squeeze it
through.
Correct. Do you find that people prefer the dots to straws?
Well, I have. It's about 50-50. Although this year I did, maybe it was more like 2/3 and 1/3 dots to cheese straws.
And by the way, I thought what you wore on the red carpet at the Oscars smoked just about everybody else. That was so, I don't know if you saw Helen Mirren looking at you. She was like, I want that freaking dress.
She told me later.
She did. You saw her. Yeah. Did you go to the Vanity Fair party?
Of course.
Oh God. I'll never ever get to go do that. Anyway. All right. So obviously we're here with Sandy Waddell talking about her particular culinary passion, which is these cheese dots. So when do you start making them every year?
My season is between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Okay. And during that time, how many of these things do you crank out?
Well, the cheese dots, I did over 14 pounds.
And then how many cheese straws?
Cheese straws, I did 55 dozen this year.
I get this deep cheddar flavor, but the heat is right alongside that. Now, I'm not going to ask you for the recipe. Is that cayenne or what kind of pepper is
there
it?
There is cayenne. There's other
stuff that you're not going to tell me about. Do I get a little garlic or onion powder in there?
Yes.
Do I get a little paprika in there?
No.
Well, you should. A little smoked paprika might be really nice.
I might try that.
I have heard tell that one of the secrets to this recipe that I know you're not going to give us, and I don't want it. I'm just happy to have the bag here, is that you are incredibly careful about sourcing ingredients.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, that speaks really well of you because a lot of people would just grab anything and make this stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of where you, I mean, do you have like cheese makers that are just making cheese specifically for you? What's the deal?
No, I get cheese from a little grocery store, independent grocery store in my hometown.
And that is? What's your hometown?
Sparta, Georgia.
Sparta. This is Sparta! I see. I already knew that, but I had to see that's a movie. Never mind. You say it's an independent grocery store? It's like a mom and pop kind of thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes. And it's called, interestingly enough, Sandy's IGA.
Oh, it's part of the IGA chain.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of people in the Midwest might know IGA, and it's named Sandy's, but not for you.
Correct.
Okay. It's some other Sandy.
Yes.
Okay.
Who actually owns the grocery store.
Okay. So what is it about the cheese in Sparta, Georgia that you can't get from a fine purveyor somewhere else?
Well, my mother always insisted on using New York sharp cheese, and it's very difficult to find New York sharp. You can find New York extra sharp, or you can find sharp extra sharp, but not New York sharp.
Extra sharp is okay. You can get extra sharp because New Yorkers are extra sharp.
Yes.
But you can't get just sharp.
Right.
Which isn't quite as sharp as extra sharp.
Correct.
So you find that if you use extra sharp,
it throws everything off. The cheese taste that you get from the New York sharp.
So you make this special trip to Sparta.
Yes. Well, I go once a week to Sparta to visit my mother.
You make this pilgrimage to a special place for a special ingredient that apparently here in Georgia, we get a New York sharp that apparently is not sharp enough for New Yorkers, and so they send it out of state.
Right.
Okay, so you've bought your three cases.
Right.
You go home.
Yes.
What happens?
Well, I make cheese straws one batch at a time.
How many ovens are we talking about?
One oven.
You got one oven. Mm-hmm. So you don't have like a big batch recipe. You've got just one little recipe that you do over and over again.
You can't do a big batch because it has to be mixed with your hands, and you can't do that in a huge batch. You've got to have the warmth of your hands to help melt the cheese.
Well, let's talk about the cookie press for a second. Because now, is this like a big plunger device thing that looks like a cock gun? What do you use?
It does look like a cock gun, but it's a small one.
Do you have a favorite pan, favorite cookie sheet?
I like the Air Bake. It's not
Air Bake. Okay, this isn't an actual endorsement for Air Bake.
No.
But if anyone from Air Bake happens to be listening, we are open to negotiating a sponsorship situation. So the Air Bake's, of course, just correct me if I'm wrong. That's actually a 2-ply pan that has an air space, an air gap in between the two pieces of metal, which supposedly is supposed to add a little bit of an insulative power. All right. So how many racks can you do in your one oven at a time?
Oh, I just one.
One.
I do one pan at a time.
Diamonds. I can't believe this. So you mix this stuff like a batch at a time.
Yes.
And in one oven on one rack, one sheet pan at a time.
Yes.
This is as artisanal a product as they come. I mean, this is small batch stuff.
Yes.
Have you thought of expanding? I mean, a second oven wouldn't break you. A big star like you. I mean, you could get two ovens.
I just have so much other things going on that, and I get a great deal of pleasure from the fact that people seem to enjoy.
Okay. Well, I mean, they're delicious. Have people told you that they're the best they've ever had?
Yes.
Well, why do you think that is? They are delicious. I'm
telling you. They're really good.
Now, what you mentioned your mom in this, who you're still visiting, and I assume paying some kind of royalty to.
No.
Well, she's a sucker. But you made reference to the recipe coming from her?
Yes.
So where did she get it?
I thought it was from her mother, but I questioned her about it, and she said she didn't actually remember the base recipe that she started with. Now, I've taken her recipe, and I've put my own twist on it. Mine are a little spicier.
Have you, do they freeze pretty well?
Yes, they freeze really well.
I imagine because there's a good bit of fat in them from the cheese that you need to wrap them up very, very airtight in order for the fat not to absorb funky flavors in the in the freezer. So I could potentially keep myself in Sandy's cheese dots all year long if I'm show some restraint and some discipline and keep them frozen.
Correct.
I've been lucky enough to get bags of these around the holiday season for the last 3 years running. And I actually have more people accepting invitations to my home now because they know I've got them. In fact, I'll call up certain people and they'll say, yeah, we might be able to come that night. Hey, do you have some of those cheese dots? And I say yes, and all of a sudden they're available. So thanks. You've actually boosted my place in food culture and in my neighborhood. So thank you, Sandy. What else? Wonderful to have you here. I'm sure that everybody listening to this podcast familiar with your work and in so many different ways. But hey, you're also a maker and lover of cheese straws. Good to know. Thanks very much for being on the cast.
Thank you.
Today's incredibly brief reading on the Browncast comes from the Curiosities of Food, originally published in 1815 and written by Peter Lund Simmons. And I'm going to read from the chapter titled Rodentia, as in rodents. Passing now to the rodents, or gnawing animals, we find that the very large gray squirrel is very good eating. The flesh of the squirrel is much valued by the Dyaks, whoever the hell that is, and it will doubtless hereafter be prized for the table of Europeans. Well, I think that's about enough about rodents today, don't you think? Hi, this is Alton Brown. Welcome back to the Alton Brown Cast. We're now moving into the phase of the show where we're going to deal with your questions. Of course, we're taking those via email at askalton@altonbrown.com, also Twitter at Alton Brown. And we're also lining up some callers. Who am I talking to?
This is Erica from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, Erica from Phoenix, Arizona. It's Alton Brown. How are you?
I am fantastic, and it is a privilege to talk to you, Mr. Brown.
Well, thank you very much. You are caller number one of ever. You're the first call that we have ever taken on the Alton Brown Cast. And if that doesn't raise a tear, I mean, I'm openly crying right now over having this experience with you. What the heck is going on in Arizona?
The Valley of the Sun is actually, excuse me, quite rainy today. So it's an interesting way to start off the weekend.
Well, especially considering that you live in a desert. Okay, let's get down to your question.
Okay, I am not a fan of fish or seafood. I've tried, you know, lobster, scallops, crab, tilapia, salmon, and I'm just only really particularly care for tuna fish. And I'm trying to integrate more fish into my diet. And I was wondering, since you're really good into the sustainable sea creatures, if there's a fish that you could recommend to somebody that really doesn't have a big liking for fish, so a good starter fish.
Okay, well, let's go into this. What is it about tuna that you like, and what kind of tuna do you like? Do you like canned tuna, or do you like fresh tuna?
I am of the canned variety. I'm certain there's like a little ocean that they farm those little, nice little canned tunas out just for me. And it's the skipjack. I'm not a big fan of the albacore either.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Well, that tells. Don't apologize. I mean, it's not like you're eating members of my family. If you're you like skipjack, you don't like the albacore. So here's what I would suggest to you. Let's not move you directly into fresh fish. Okay. I think that there might be some tragedy in that. If you like canned skipjack tuna, and most Americans do, and there's no shame in that, have you tried other canned fish?
I have not.
Okay, well, that's the first place that I would go if I were you. And here are the ones that I would try. I would definitely think that you should try sardines, as long as they're packed in oil. One of my favorite fish, probably my favorite fish on earth. But you would also probably like canned salmon. And here's the reason that I say this. My wife despises fish. In fact, if it has spent any actual lifetime in the ocean, odds are very good she's not going to eat it. I've tried for 20 years to make her fish that she would like, and I have failed miserably. She will, however, eat things made with canned salmon. So I extrapolate from that if you like canned skipjack tuna, that you might like canned salmon. So I would see if maybe you could find a recipe for salmon croquettes, which is basically a crab cake except with salmon in it, and give that a try. That's something. If you download I don't think we ever did a crab cake. Now, yeah, we did. We did a crab cake. If you go and Google Good Eats crab cake and just substitute the crab for canned salmon, I think that might start you on the road to rehabilitation. All right, we got to take another call. Good luck with the canned salmon.
All right, thank you, Alton. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. All right, who's next? You're on with Alton Brown at the Alton Brown Cast. Who am I talking to?
Hi, this is Adam from Charleston, South Carolina.
Adam from Charleston. How are you, sir?
Doing good. How about yourself, man?
I'm doing good, man. What's your question?
I was just going to ask you, I know you're a huge, avid fan of calamari.
I do like me some squid. You know, if we don't eat them, they'll eat us. I swear to God, we have got to eat all the squid we can hold.
Your thing on it. But I was just going to ask, what is your personal favorite preparation of it?
Wow. I really like stuffed. squid quite a bit. I mean, you look at it this way. When you got their little heads, you got this perfect little protein tube that you can stuff full of all kinds of goodness. So when you move away from calamari, you can do that. You can actually, this is a really cool trick, Adam. You can look up almost any wonton recipe in the world or pot sticker recipe in the world, mix up the filling, and instead of putting it inside a wonton wrapper, stuff it inside a squid tube, run a toothpick through it, steam it, and in about 7 or 8 minutes, you got yourself some deliciousness.
That sounds awesome. Personally, I do a lamb stuffed squid on a grill.
You stuff lamb into a squid?
On a grill. And then you grill it with a little olive oil, garlic, and thyme. Perfect.
Well, was this ground lamb, or what did you do to... I want to understand this, because it's not a dish I've ever heard of before. How did you treat
rather
that?
What happens is we put it through the meat grinder on a medium fine grain.
Okay.
And inside of it, we actually put mint, a little bit of basil, and a little bit of thyme to grind through. You know, it was just lamb shank. And then towards the end, right before you put it on the grill, you just stuff it in, you know, run a skewer through it, and then you have a perfectly grilled lamb stuffed squid.
How did those sell?
Actually, pretty good. We did pretty good with them. It didn't last that long. A lot of people aren't willing to try something that sounds so...
Yeah, a baby sheep stuck into a cephalopod. I can see how that could be a hard sell, but it does sound tasty. All right, Adam, we've got to go. I hope we could give you a little good advice there, and good luck wiping out the squid population.
Thanks, Alton.
Okay. Our next caller, I believe, is contacting us from Chicago, and we'll bring them onto the line. I'm probably going to say this wrong. Is it Saqib?
Yes, this is Saqib. How are you doing, Al?
Sorry, Saqib. I said your name wrong. I figured I had a 50-50 chance of getting it right. All right, Saqib, what's on your mind today?
First of all, thanks for having us, and thanks for being so interactive with your fans. I'm looking to do a cooking show of my own on the internet, a vlog, basically, on YouTube. And I understand you have experience in this field.
None whatsoever. I don't know anything about cooking shows. I don't know. I've never made one for the internet before. I'm going to, but I haven't done that yet.
Okay. Well, what tips do you have? What advice do you have for someone like me?
My advice is be real careful about asking for advice, because most people give bad advice. My advice to you is don't ever take advice. Decide what you're going to do, do it, and don't give a damn what anybody else thinks about it. Because you will become discouraged, and if you follow the advice, it's probably going to be bad. So do yourself a favor and just do what you're going to do and be damned with the rest of it.
So if I follow this advice, I shouldn't follow your advice, technically.
See, you're kind of screwed because you called me. And now we're stuck. We're stuck in a paradox loop now, because I'm giving you the best advice that you can ever get, yet I've just told you not to take it. What are you going to do with that, dude? But if I give you any other advice, you might take it, and then it won't be the best advice that you ever got. See what happens when you ask for advice?
I do.
Good luck, Saqib. We're going to keep moving. Who do we have? Okay, we got Rachel. Rachel from Miami. Are you there, Rachel?
Hi, Austin.
Hi, Rachel. How are things in Miami?
Great.
Hi. Are you in Miami?
Yes.
Excellent. What's your question?
I was thinking of making beef tartare.
I was too. Just now. What about it?
I was thinking maybe I could just add different herbs and experiment with that.
Yep.
Do you have any recommendations, maybe?
Oh, yeah. Well, you didn't say anything about that. I thought you were just calling for some kind of blessing, a tacit blessing on your beef tartare. Let me ask you a question. What cut of beef are you thinking about chopping all the smithereens there?
Someone told me sirloin.
Sirloin, I think, is perfect. It's relatively low in connective tissue. It's got a lot of flavor and a good bit of chew. Here's the thing. You're going to want to bring a little fat and a little acid to the party. I like the traditional accompaniments. I would probably toss in just a wee bit of olive oil to give it a little bit of fattiness. And then I like the traditional capers and a little bit of red onion, really, really well chopped up and mixed into that. That's what I go for. But then I'm a traditionalist. Do you have any capers?
No, I don't.
The grocery store has them, and they have red onion too. But you're gonna want to chop those up really fine. Are you planning on going with the classic accompaniment of chopped hard boiled eggs?
No, I was just thinking of the beef and herbs.
Okay. Well, if you want just herbs in there, go with parsley. Parsley has got the right bite to stand up to a raw beef application like that. Other things like basil tend to get kind of insipid, and the leaf actually turns dark on you. So I would go with chopped flat leaf parsley, a little bit of caper, a little bit of red onion, and a little bit of olive oil to start. And of course, you're going to need a little bit of salt on that as well.
Thank you.
Okay, listen, good luck, Rachel.
You too. All the best.
Okay, yeah, I need all the, this has proven that I need all the luck that I can get as well. All right, we're going to go to another call. This is going to be, I think, Jessica. Are you in Seattle, Jessica? Is that where you are?
Yes, I am.
Well, how the heck are things in Seattle?
Surprisingly sunny right now.
Well, you know what? All the times that I've ever been to Seattle, I've never actually seen the sun.
Well, that's pretty normal here, but, you know, it's surprisingly sunny right now, and I don't really know what to do with that.
Well, what's your question, ma'am, besides what to do when that giant burning ball of hydrogen shows itself?
I know. I still have no idea what to do there. But I actually have an uncooking-related question.
Okay, I'll see how I can do with it.
I was wondering who was your favorite Doctor Who villain and why?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't want to sound trite, but it's hard not to love a Dalek, you know? I mean, they've got the attitude. They've got a big old, you know, plunger sticking out of their front end. They got their death ray. You know, they pretty much have cornered the market on the word exterminate. I don't think you can beat that. And it's a giant metal thing with a squid on the inside. Right? So, I mean, how do you best that? Well, look, I've got to move on. I've got other callers. So, bye, Jessica. All right, I think I'm now talking to Phil on the phone. Phil from somewhere in East Tennessee. Are you there, Phil?
Hey, Elton. How's it going?
Things are going okay. It's our very first day of recording our podcast, and it's fun. We're having a good time. What's up with you?
Well, I'm a graduate student here, and I'm trying to eat a little bit healthier, but as I'm sure you know, it's hard to get greens and veggies and fruits to stay fresh for a while, for more than a day or two. I was just wondering if you had any suggestions for eating fresh while not being able to go to the store every day or two.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions about your life. You're a student. Did you say you're a graduate student?
Yes, sir.
Okay, where are you living? What are your living circumstances like?
A one-bedroom apartment just outside of East Tennessee State University.
So you have a kitchen. You've got a refrigerator, and you've got... You're not living in a dorm. I mean, you've got actual appliances.
Right.
If you could even make it to the grocery store once a week, would that be crazy talk?
No, I think that's doable.
And you have a decent grocery store somewhere in the vicinity?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, good. So here's the deal. I want you to think about creating a list that would allow you to have a good bit of versatility through the week. But what we're going to do is we're going to concentrate on things that we know have a refrigerator or shelf life in excess of, let's say, 10 days, just in case things get really crazy and out of control. Okay. The other thing that I want to know is, do you own a blender? I have to tell you, I'm a huge smoothie fan, and I lost a lot of weight by making sure that I got certain nutrition that I needed into me quickly, and very often something that you can throw in a blender doesn't have to be the most pristine piece of produce in the drawer. I, for instance, make sure that I've got to eat dark green vegetables every day. I made that a rule. Every day I will have dark green vegetables, at least one serving, if not two. And one of the things that I found is that I could buy kale. Kale is a great vegetable because it is quite hardy. It can put up with a lot of time in the refrigerator without breaking down very quickly. And that is something that can be sauteed. It can be stewed. It can be or thrown raw into a blender for a smoothie. And I make smoothies with some kale, banana, and some apple and a little bit of almond milk. I don't really drink much dairy. I don't really drink dairy at all. I keep it around to make biscuits with, but otherwise I use almond milk. And you can do that. And right there, you've gotten in some good fruit and at least one serving of green vegetables, which are always good. Sweet potatoes are a wonderful thing to keep around because they keep almost forever on the shelf, at least a couple of weeks. And you can literally just throw one in the oven, put the oven on 350 and come back in an hour and it'll be done. And when I have a a sweet potato. I usually put a little cottage cheese on it, which I actually think tastes pretty gosh darn good. That's one of the few dairies that I reach for on a regular basis. So there are two things right there that are hearty, easy to do, inexpensive, and keep for a really long time. What you want to avoid is lettuces, anything that's going to wilt on you quickly or requires a whole lot of work. It's like, you know what? I really love beets, but I find that they always seem to go bad in the refrigerator before I can cook them. So what I do is when I buy them, I cook them immediately and keep them in their cooked state. I just wrap them up in foil, rub them with a little olive oil, and roast them for an hour until they're soft. And then I refrigerate them so I've already got them cooked. Most of us let things go bad in the refrigerator because we were putting off the cooking process. A lot of foods will keep longer if you go ahead and pre-cook them first. Does that sound like something you could do?
Yeah, I think so. Thanks, Alvin.
All right, I'm going to turn very quickly to the internet, which is pretty much overflowing with questions. Here's a good one. Amanda at Snap That Girl. I don't know exactly what that means. She says, would you ever consider becoming a challenger in Kitchen Stadium? Hey, Amanda, thanks for the question. The answer is absolutely freaking not. I will not be a challenger in Kitchen Stadium, not because I'm scared of the Iron Chefs. I could smoke Morimoto easy, as long as the secret ingredient was like canned beanie weenies or something. But I would never, ever go into Kitchen Stadium as a competitor because I don't want somebody to get a shot at my job. I mean, what would happen if I go down there to fight in Kitchen Stadium and somebody comes up and makes me look bad by doing my job so well? And what happens when my contract comes up? You know what? I lose my job. So that's not ever going to happen, ever. Not in this lifetime. I'll stay right up there where I'm supposed to be. All right, here's a question from Luann. Luann, I hope you're listening. Luann has an interesting question. I've actually heard this one a few times, which is, what is the difference between French bread and Italian bread? Do you have a good recipe for either? Well, I do, but there are truthfully a lot of really good recipes for both on the internet. The real difference is that a French bread is what we call a lean bread. It has little or no fat in it. Typically, actually, no fat at all. Italian bread is a lot like that, but it does usually have at least a bit of olive oil in it, which makes for a softer dough. Italian bread also tends to go stale a little slower because it does have that fat in it. Then, of course, there's the actual difference in shape. French loaves are the traditional baguette. You know, if you've ever seen that postcard of the French guy riding a bicycle with the bread under his arm, that's a typical baguette. We're dealing with something that's only about 2 to 2.5 inches in diameter typically. So there's a lot more crust to a baguette and a lot less interior. An Italian loaf, on the other hand, is a much kind of wider loaf. There's more interior to it, which is why it also tends to be a little bit on the softer side. And, you know, honestly, there's thousands of recipes online for these. I do have some that I trust, but I'm not going to unleash those on you right now. Well, this has been fun, and we should definitely do it again. I'm Alton Brown, and you've been listening to and hopefully enjoying the Browncast, which could change names next week if somebody comes up with something better. Until then, may the food be with you.